No, I'm just saying my performance after context.
So I'm just going to talk and tell us about potential impacts on the collective strategy.
Thank you. I'm first really excited to talk here. So I'm just going to talk about the work we've been doing in the last 4 months with Abhiken here. I'm doing actually my master's thesis from KFL in Switzerland.
What is KFL?
It's Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Lausanne, translated in French. Okay. So, well, I guess people here are quite used to the concept of modified dispersion relation. There's been a number of thought experiments as well as various explicit models of quantum or possible quantum gravity that leads to modified dispersion relations for different quantum fields. It has even been shown by, for example, papers in quantum Smalling, that this can be even made compatible with a generalized principle of relativity. So what do people usually do? Well, first of all, they have to choose a certain class of modified dispersion relation. It can be polynomial dispersion relations or low order directions to the linear dispersion relation. So what I mean, of course, by dispersion relation is the relation between energy and momentum or energy and wavelength. Then what you have to do is, once you've chosen your own modified dispersion relation, you implement it in the calculation of some physics that is involving some high energy physics. And then carry out the calculations and at the end of the day determine if there is some measurable effect of that and what are the how big these effects can be. Okay, in particular, this has been carried out for inflation. We have a huge number of papers about it. So it has been shown that inflation can be sensitive to Planck scale physics, at least for certain dispersion relations. However, the level of sensitivity is not always clear. It's at least of sigma squared. Now, there's also this problem of back reaction. This modified dispersion relation should also modify the back reaction, which in turn should modify their own calculations. And very recently, it has been suggested by Brandon Murder and collaborators that we could maybe plug this back reaction back into the redefinition of the inflation potential. Anyways, here in inflation, this could be a possible window where we could actually go and measure some effects of Planck-scale physics. There's other problems where the same kind of program has been carried out. For example, the black hole spectrum, or the problem of gamma ray bursts. Anyways, in all these works, what people do is at first choose some ad hoc dispersion relation. So it's really a particular class of dispersion relation, or even one particular function that they choose. Sometimes just they draw corrections to a linear dispersion relation, but they're never able to work until the end with total general class of dispersion relations. And if they have to use a regularization or denormalization, essentially, it's never shown if the result of the calculations are dependent or not on the way we visualize the calculations. So this leads to our program here. So first of all, inflation and all black hole radiation are pretty complicated physical effects. So here we choose certainly structurally the most simple effect that still involves energy physics. So we chose the Casimir effect. Okay. Of course, it's much more simple than all the other cases. Space time is flat, so it's really easy. Now we're going to work with really generic class for dispersion relation, and we're going to be able to keep that until the end. We're going to make sure that all our results are going to be independent of the regularization scheme that we use explicitly, and then. Once we've done that, we're able to go and draw most general conclusions about this problem of UV and IR coupling. So we're not here expecting to have really measurable effects, but the purpose of his work is essentially to have the Casimir effect, simple thing, to work as a model where we can actually find a precise mapping that maps any dispersion relation into the Casimir force, and then with that precise mapping, analyze it. And with this, we'll also be able to see a bit more what mathematical methods we can use that actually are going to succeed. Right. Okay, so let's go a little bit more into the calculations. Let's go to back to the basics very quickly. Chemical field quantization. So we're going to work with a real massless scalar field. So again, the simplest case. So as usual, we put our field in a box. We quantize it. First of all, we decompose it into its Fourier modes. Then we consider each mode as a quantum harmonic oscillator. We impose the usual canonical limitation relations. So since it's each mode is a harmonic oscillator, it has its own ground state energy. And at the end of the day, you have two sum over all modes, which is this expression here. And even in the vacuum, we have our scalar field carries them for the infinite energy. So this infinite vacuum energy is the key fact here for the whole Casimir effect thing. Because now we basically, in the Casimir effect, we essentially have our field in the box. And then we see what's going on if I move the boundaries. So if I move the boundaries, of course, the set of the allowed modes in my box is going to change. It's explicitly dependent on the length between the two plates. So I'm going to have also a difference here in this sum. And if I have a difference in energy, that also means that I'm going to have a force appearing between my plates. And of course, I can calculate explicitly the force by taking the derivative of the energy with respect to the distance of the plates. OK. So explicitly, the model we're working with, we take, well, this is the phrase that made it cheesy, but anyways, has some colors. We have two regions in space, one and two, and we consider the total distance in between the two walls here to the M, and we put one movable wall plate here at the distance L of the first plate. So this is the whole space we're considering. And at the end of the day, we're going to have the second wall here move to infinity, so that essentially the space we're working in is 0 and 2 plus infinity. And this allows us to have essentially a discrete spectrum of wave numbers here, and then a continuous spectrum on the second part. Okay? So we're going to work with the usual unmodified spectrum in region 1, which is n plus. So we have a set here, I write down the set for the wave numbers in the first region, n pi over L. This is really a usual thing. But this is where we introduce some change. We write down our dispersion relation between the frequency and the wavelength, wave number, like this. And so our function f is really here what we're interested in. This is really what we're going to work with. For sure, we have to have that lower energy if we recover the linear dispersion relation. Of course, we want to have it to be always positive. And we introduce here explicitly this KPL that we can call Planck scale, or it is any scale where new physics is going to become important. Okay? So it could be Planck scale, it could be a few orders away. It doesn't really matter, it's just the scale of the new physics. And for now, F is really totally general. We have no such data on it apart from these two things here. Right, so of course, as in the usual case, the energy density in my space is still going to be infinite. So we'll need a high energy UV regulator, or what I call later UV cutoff. For simplicity here, right now, we're just going to use an exponential damping function. which means that if I write down my energy between the plates, it's just the sum over frequencies, and then I regulate it with this exponential damping, with alpha being a positive parameter. Now, if I put alpha back to zero, this goes back to one, and then I recover the usual divergent quantity here. So that's for the part in between the plates, and then on the other side of the moving plates, I can write the same thing, but since the foot wall is going to go to infinity, the spectrum here is going to become continuous, so I can write this here as a Riemann sum, and I got just an integral of 4. So this is the energy density in region 2. Okay? So the quartz now, as we've said, is just the derivative of the total energy with respect to movements in my plate. So this is what I can write. Here I don't have the d by dl appearing because this being independent of L, the energy, total energy outside is just m minus L times this density. Okay? So it's just like the length times my density. And if I take the derivatives of that, I just get. All right? Okay, so this expression, if I write it down, it's going to be pretty messy. But what's its essential feature is that this first part here involves the sum, whereas the second part involves an integral. And basically, I have to find a way to take the difference between these two things. Fortunately, we have the Euler-Maclaurin formula, which essentially allows me to calculate a sum as an integral plus some corrections. So some corrections that involve the derivatives of my function. So this is going to be just a sum or a series. And then I put plus dot 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 just because we actually have another integral rest here. But we can take it here back. Essentially, if my function that I'm summing over is infinitely differentiable, then I can take this sum here, k going to infinity, because I'm allowed to have this. And essentially, since everything is bounded, I can, the effect of this rest term is just taken into account by looking at the convergence property of the series. So I'm now going to get the series, okay? Maybe I should note here that these are the Bernoulli numbers, so it's the Bernoulli polynomials divided into 0. And they have an essential property, which is that the odd Bernoulli numbers are 0, which means that actually my sum here, I'm going to have only the odd derivatives here. Okay? Maybe the final point that I quickly want to make is that in our case, we're summing up to infinity. So again, there's here a little issue about convergence of these sums, but we can be careful and take care of all these little problems. So we just apply now this Euler-Maclaurin formula for this part of the sum. So here, this is the messy expression that I get for the force by just summing my two distributions. So what do I do? I rewrite this sum as the integral plus the series. So you see that essentially I'm going to get the integral of this same expression. I can actually integrate it by parts and get something that looks like this. This integral plus some bounded terms. So this integral here, you notice it's the same as that one, and they're going to cancel out of each other. And the bounded terms are 0 because of our regularization. So the important point is that now I have a sum plus an integral, I transform it into basically an integral plus an integral, and I get 0. So I get rid of all that stuff, and the only thing that's left is essentially this series here involving the moving numbers. This is essentially, in a bit more complicated way, what's happening in the usual Casimir effect calculations. If you look at Casimir's original paper, that's exactly what he's doing. It's just a bit simple. It doesn't have to deal with theory, but it's fine. Right. Okay, so in order to get our final result, so first of all, we introduce this damping function, this exponential damping, in order to control the infinities and to be able to make all these calculations. So now we can remove it. That means just have take the limits of our cutoff parameter go back to zero. And rather than do this, I give you here the final answer. So essentially, that just comes from this series. Okay. Just a remark: this zeta function here is comes just by rewriting down with the Bernoulli numbers. There's a relationship between the two. It's just nice to write it that way. Again, you see here that only the odds derivatives of our dispersion relation appear. Remember, f is essentially a dispersion relation, and that's it. So now, this is kind of the basic result, because I can plug any dispersion relation, as long as it's analytic, because I have to throw off infinitely differentiable, because I have to be able to take these derivatives to infinity. So I take any dispersion relation I want, I just plug it in here, and I get the Kesner results. So this is really a general result. And we can now essentially go and analyze what this means. So all the information I want, I can get, is just plugging this box formula. And first of all, just want to be consistent, if we take a linear dispersion relation, we plug it in, and we just get minus pi over 3/4 L squared, which is exactly the result of Kesner's first calculations. So we're happy this is safe. Okay, so let's start maybe with an analytic dispersion relation that I can write like this. I can write down specifically all the derivatives that I need. This is essentially what I get. So I don't write down all the constants, but it doesn't really matter. I want to go into essentially quality analysis here. Well, first of all, this is essentially a series in one with L, being the distance between my plates. So, essentially, this is always going to go to zero, because I have this extra one with a factor here in front, which is expected. Then when the plates go very far from each other, there can be a force in between, whatever the dispersion relation is. Now, if you look at the coefficients of my series, you see that you have this extra minus one to the r side, which means that this is kind of an uncongruent series, but this is not. So there's really a difference. Like, this is important in terms of radius convergence of my series. Other important fact is that I have here this extra factorial function, which is going to, if r is allowed to go very high, then this is going to blow up very fast. And at the end of the day, it's going to be the dominant term in that series. Again, it's just important in terms of radius convergence of the series. Final point, we want to look at measurable scales. So measurable scales nowadays for Kesner effect is about 10 to the minus 7 meters, which means that this ratio is about 10 to the minus 27. So as R grows, this is going to kill a lot. Of course, there's still this factorial blow up. So as we go higher in the coefficients here, we're going to have a competing effect between this term, this polynomial decrease, and this factorial blow up. Okay? So for small r, this is going to be dominant. And if r is allowed to go really high, which might be the case for analytic dispersion relation, then this is going to be the most dominant term. Okay. So in order to have a non-zero radius convergence, my force is well defined at least somewhere, I have essentially to have these new 2r-1 to kill out this factorial blowup. So at least for r getting really, really big, I have to have this decaying at least as fast as 1 over 2r-1 factorial. Okay, this is especially if I have a polynomial dispersion relation, which is a special case, not analytic, then this is, of course, this criteria is, of course, met. We have zero after a certain point. Okay. Right, so let's look at polynomial dispersion relations. So here, we have zero after some point. So we don't have any issues with convergence. My series is not a series, it's just going to be a sub. Right, because the f prime or f derivative is going to be zero after some point. Okay, so no problem about convergence. It's defined for any distance between my plates. But, as we'll see later, there might be some really new behaviors close to the Planck scale, which is expected. That's where we're making modifications in our dispersion relations. So we can distinguish between two different cases. The first one is if the few coefficients that we have are decreasing like this, so killing out the factorial blowout. The only thing that is left in our series, so this is going to be 1, essentially, over time. So it's just a series 1 times a 40-order degrees. Okay? So instead of going like 1 over L squared, which is the usual case, we're going to have a function that goes like 5 over L 4 or 1 over L 6 or whatever. But then it's going to decrease the polynomial, which means that at measurable scales, when LP, the Planck over L is going to the planet, and to the 0.7, to the minus 0.7, sorry, there's going to be no measurable effects, which is, again, expected. However, let's imagine one, at least one, of these coefficients here is going to be of order 1. So this will be the tricky part. If this is going to be of order 1, for some sufficiently high r, so that the factorial is dominant with respect to the polynomial, then that means that this extra term is going to have a huge effect. It can be a number as big as I want. So if I choose mu to r minus 1 to be of order 1, for r that is sufficiently big, I can have a propagation of UV effects as far as I want to be IR. Okay? Okay, so however, we have to choose R essentially to be of order 10 to the 27. So that means that if my polynomial dispersion relation looks like x plus x to the power 10 to the 27, that, well, this is huge, but anyways, I can have, even with a finite series, like not an infinite series, I could have any amount of propagating of ID and IUV and IR coupled. Okay, before I just go through examples to show you all that, we insisted at the beginning that our result has to be independent of the cutoff function that we choose, that means any regularization. So actually, we want to be able to choose any function gamma such that, so it regularizes my sum, this would be the energy divergent, and that if I take, if I multiply this factor, I'm getting a finite sum, so before I have this exponential damping. And of course, I want it to be a cutoff function, that means that it doesn't affect the lower energy, it cuts off the high energy. And now, the essential point is that I want it to be C infinity so that I can use the Riemann Lorentz. I can use my formula that I had before. And if I can use Riemann McLaurin, basically all the calculations I've done up to now are doable again. And what I'm going to get is the same series with no modification. And so this is enough to show that whatever cutoff function I choose, I'm always going to get the same answer. Of course, it has to be a cutoff and regularize my something correctly. But then I'd be able to cut off, carry out these calculations, remove the cutoff, and get the same answer. Again, well, you have to, I think, go through all the calculations to see that it's actually right, but you can do it. So let's just go into concrete examples. First of all, I talk about analytic dispersion relations. So let's take essentially an exponential. So in order for it to be like a linear at the beginning, we have to take e to the power e to the x minus 1. Okay? And I got here force as a function of the distance between the plates. Well, this is essentially L over L Planck, which means that the L Planck would be 1. So I plug here the usual Casimir force, 1 over L square, and I plug here what I get with an exponential dispersion relation. So what do we see? We see, first of all, that, well, as we go far from the Planck length, we have essentially the difference going to 0 very fast. But flow to the pipeline, there's starts to be discrepancy. And if you look at it, the series is actually not well defined for very small L. That's this one of the convergence. And so, like here in this little part, this the chasm report is just not well defined. So this is just this really leads us, will suggest the idea again of some kind of a minimal length scale that we see appearing here in these calculations by just the series not defining the model. Other case, polynomial, no problem. As I said, it's defined everywhere. So I take here the simplest case of polynomials for equation, it's this cube. And I plot again the two things. So I see, again, they converge properly to each other for long distances. But as we go close to the Planck scale, we can have a totally different behavior. In this case, of course, it gets positive when the two plates get really close to each other. Okay? So this is just three examples of the use of our results. Yeah?
In the first case, on the previous slide,
yeah.
You say that as you take L to zero, the force remains finite, but the series suddenly just breaks down. And
exactly. Yeah. If you actually calculate the radius of convergence, sorry?
Yeah, you can. Because you might expect to see divergence in the force.
Of course, of course.
Yeah. But it doesn't happen.
No, I don't know why. But you can actually calculate explicitly the radius of convergence because you know all the coefficients. That's why you take an exponential. It's 1 over r square, r factorial. So you can do it, and then you can calculate the radius of convergence in 1 over the square root of the limit of the coefficients. And you see that it blows up close to 1/2.
Okay. Okay, for example, the geometric series, radius of convergence 1. It's divergent. The function 1 over 1 minus 2 is divergent only at 2 equals 1. But it's not divergent anywhere else on the basis, it's not a separate one.
Oh, that's right. So the question is.
It's a case like that.
But the question is your original integral, or whatever, your original expression, would be well defined if and only if the series converges. Is that correct? Or have you.
What do you mean by my original integral?
Well, you had written a pair of sums, and then you converted one sum to an integral.
Yeah, okay.
And then you did some trickery involving the other part. And had you not done that trickery, would you have found a well-defined expression even smaller? Yeah?
Well, the thing is, you can't do it because we have two infinite things, so you have to make a difference between the two. So there's no other way. You have to leave
some cut off. So, I mean, you might cut off
like. Oh, I mean, like, don't figure out how to cut off.
Well, you could ask whether your original expression is regularized at the well-defined limit when you send alpha to zero or infinity.
Yeah, can I haven't looked at it.
Because, for example, this thing might be more awesome, for example, and then you might ask this example you were giving. And then you might ask whether or not that more awesome is the physically correct one or not.
Of course.
Anything beyond mathematical.
Yeah. So. You're right. Here we only analyze it when you actually remove the cutout and get rid of that stuff. But that's true. We can look at that. Yeah. Right. Keep the cutout in.
And
you
can keep the cutout and then take the limit to zero in the original expression. It wasn't clear to me whether or not, if you did that, the well defined limits of that expression is equivalent to the convergence of the series.
Yeah.
Or like
I
being down in the larger
yeah, right. Okay. So we continue to try to analyze what we got. But we'd like to have a better idea. So we can actually look at this whole problem from a functional analytic point of view. Essentially what we found is an operator that maps the set of dispersion relations into the set of chasm reports. Okay, this is two sets of functions, f of k, and then the forces depending on L. And we're able to write down the explicit expression for that operator, which is this. It's explicit, and again, we have all the information we want in there, but it's not intuitive. It's really hard to see what's going on here. It's a series involving differential operators. So we'd like to have an integral representation of that operator. So I give you here one answer that we got, which is we have this integral. This looks kind of like Laplace transform, which is when you write it from 0 to infinity of something times e to the minus k lambda. Maybe I should say lambda is just 2 over L time, so it's essentially the length. But you see that we are actually integrating here from the dispersion relation, which is essentially vector into the complex plane. At the end, you can take the real, only the real part of that. So this is fully exact, except for this extra zeta to R factor. But this is, well, this is not really that important, because essentially you're going to get the same answer up to a factor of pi or more than pi, let's say. This is what I just said. This is essentially the past transform of the bifurcated dispersion relation. So, well, now we're not really happy satisfied with that, because this involves this analytic continuation of my dispersion relation into the complex plane. So first of all, we don't know if it's mathematically well defined, and secondly, we're looking for more intuition. That if we have to go into the complex plane, we just totally destroy our intuition. So there is a solution out, and this is just, we've seen that only the odd derivatives of our function appear. So we know that all the given part of our function is not present. Okay? So we can just write our dispersion relation like this. That means explicitly writing down the fact that it's odd. And now our central key of interest is going to be this function g. So if I plug this, now I can actually get a more useful representation of my operator. Again, somehow the class transform, but which is now involving g evaluated to the minus k squared. So what is it? Sure, again, I have to continue g analytically from the positive axis into the negative axis. But, I mean, this is not as bad as before, where I had to go into the complex way. And this expression can even be now rewritten as a Zappa class transform by using its properties with respect to differentiation. So I can, this extra factor here just translates to a 1 plus a derivative. Okay? So now I have this expression, which is definitely more convenient than, first of all, the series involving differential operators, and also about more convenient than the one with a bifurcated dispersion relation. So now I have a pretty important point. We know that the physics of the dispersion relation is all included into the positive parts, so the positive on the positive axis. However, and here we're only using the g evaluated in the negative axis. So we might think, okay, so these two problems are totally decoupled. Actually not, because analytic continuation is totally unique along a certain path. Okay, so actually the physical part of this dispersion relation, which is this, totally determines and uniquely determines this, which in turn uniquely determines my Casimir class. Which, well, again, I'm happy that I get that. It would be wrong if I wouldn't.
Did you say L and lambda were the same?
Yeah, lambda is L over L prime. We've got 2 L over L prime. So you just need to think about lambda as being L. Okay. So now we can continue our analysis with this new representation of our K operator. First of all, we've seen it's essentially the Laplace transform, which means that we have this exponential damping for large L, large Ks. So it expresses heavily all the large k behavior of my dispersion relation. Now, I can look also at the properties of what I call the kernel, I'm integrating this function with this, it's kind of a heat curve thing, what I can trickle the kernel. So let's look at that function, 1 minus k lambda, or 1 minus k l e to the minus k l. So I got it here, it has this shape. What do we see? First property is that if I integrate that from 0 to infinity, I get 0. Which means that if I add a constant to my dispersion relation, which means also adding a constant on the energy, I get zero. So this is just another way of saying that Casimir force doesn't depend on the absolute value of the vacuum energy, but only on the difference. Okay. So this is nice to see this part being thought of again in this integral kernel representation. Now, if I look at this, I see that this kernel changes sign at a certain point, which turns out to be 1 over 2L. What does it mean? That means that since I'm integrating everything over k afterwards, that we have the short k's here that add up to give a positive force, and then the large k's add up to give a negative force. And at the end, I just sum these two parts over and get the actual Casimir force. So we see there's, we see a bit more what's going on in this Casimir thing, where we have short wavelength and long wavelength kind of competing each other and adding up to something with the energy, for example, negative, for the usual dispersal relation. And finally, so it's 1 minus KL e to the minus KL. So I can plot different functions, so I'm plotting here the kernel as a function of k, and I can change the length, right? The L, the value of L. And I see that as L increases, my whole function is just moved towards k equals zero, which means that here we get very clearly that as the distance between my plates get larger, then we're probing only the very short case because of this exponential damming algorithms. So it's only when my plates are very close that I can actually go and see high energy physics. And this is really well illustrated with this typical kernel. And now comes kind of a tricky point. Okay, I told you analytic continuation is unique, for sure. But now imagine that we take our g function to look like this. So essentially on the positive axis, which is the one that's going to define my dispersal relation, it's essentially 1, up to any precision I want. However, on the negative axis, which is going to define Casimir force, I can have any behavior. I can choose. Again, especially, it can be as big as I want. What is it translated to? It translates it to a dispersal relation, which is, let's say, experimentally speaking, totally distinguishable from the linear one, and a Casimir force that is going to be totally different from the usual Casimir, like the Casimir force derived from the linear dispersal relation. Of course, this analysis is not exact, because this is not exactly 1. We don't use all these extra terms coming from the tail of my function here. But what I say is that to any experimental precision you want, you won't see the difference. So here we kind of have some kind of extreme case of violation of decoupling. I just plot here where we get, sorry about this, but it doesn't look great, but I couldn't do any better. So I choose g as plotted before, it's just a constant that is sharply peaked close to zero in the axis. And so, as I said, dispersion is relation gets essentially linear, x, and the force is totally different. So what I get here is, again, the force as a function of the distance between the plates. I plot here in green, if you can see it, which I doubt. Well, the usual one, which I can do right now, minus 1 over L squared. And in red, this is what I get with this Gaussian-corrected dispersion relation. So first of all, well, in the short L, it doesn't change much, which is expected. Then it goes positive. And then if you go very far, which I don't plot here, it's going to get negative again, and converge to zero, as expected. However, it's going to stay orders of magnitudes away from the 1 over L squared dispersion relation. If you take, for example, L to be 10 to the 5, so 10 to the 5 away from Planck length, you're going to get 30 orders of magnitudes difference in one particular place I chose. So this is huge, right? So before I actually conclude on that, just let me go on for these final points, which is that we can have also truncation effects. That means if I have a power series for my dispersion relation, the force is actually dependent on the place where I cut my series to do my calculation. I just take here one example, which is taken from this paper from Van Meegeren and Martin on inflation. So I can write this down as a power series, and then, so this is how it looks, and then look at the casular force I get. This is what I plot here. This is the usual line in purple. And then I get here in green the casular force that I get when I truncate my series at power 20. And this one is when I cut my series at power 22. So I see that for sure, for large distances, they all converge to each other. That's nice. But close, again, close to Planck length, we can have totally different behaviors, one being positive, the other negative. So this is a kind of, it might be pretty important when you're actually blowing up. It means that sometimes you really have to take into account the whole function, and that if you take only first order directions, you're going to miss some essential features. Yeah?
You put in an exponent of Gaussian theorem. That's rather singular there in synergy. The question is, when you did this Laplace transform, there's no boundary conditions that in synergy or Laplace conditions that allow you to rotate the transfer of the way you did. Is that formula you wrote down?
I mean, if I go through the complex axis.
Yeah.
Well, you don't need to go through it to continue it into the negative radials. You don't need to rotate it through the whole half plane. You can just continue it.
I'm just asking, so you're saying that continuation is valid independently?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, not as long as you continue it just along that line, along the real negative line.
I'm not asking whether the analytic continuation is valid, I'm asking whether the formula is valid, that integral expression.
Yeah, there's no problem about it. Okay. Yeah, it's totally well defined. There's no extra trickery behind that I don't show. No, you can actually do this integral. No problem. Okay. So what did we do, actually? First of all, with our K operator in hand, we're now able to do a classification of all the dispersion relations that we have had. Some dispersion relations have absolutely no effect on the casual force. For example, even corrections. We've seen that they don't appear at all. We can have UV corrections to the dispersion relations that contribute only to UV corrections in the casual force. We can have QDIR coupling, and with this last case that I showed you, we can have whatever you want, essentially. So we have this kind of tricky point. Mathematically, we know that the physical part of the dispersion relation totally determines the Casimir force. You first of all continue it analytically into the negative axis, and then by our operator K, you get the force. So there's everything is well defined and uniquely defined. However, we've shown that we can build, maybe artificial for the moment, but we can build functions that are as close as we want from just linear dispersion propagation, and that are as far as we want in terms of Casimir forces. So this is kind of two totally different things that we can here. So what does it mean? So essentially, if I go and measure either the Casimir force or the dispersion relation, I can essentially fit any experimental data, as long as there's some certainty in it, with some well-chosen function g. Okay? So there's basically no hope of, first of all, measuring some stuff, and out of that, trying to constrain or to build a theory of dispersion relation. Let's say I measure the Casimir force and I can predict a dispersion relation, because I can predict essentially any dispersion relation that would fit my data in the experimental data, in the experimental variables. Okay? Of course, this is not exact, because mathematically we know it's not the case, but we cannot see that mathematically from the physical world. So what we say is just that, first of all, theory has to come here first. First of all, we have to have some quantum gravity theory that is going to predict a modification in the dispersion relation, so that we have a chance an explicit expression of a function that is our dispersal image. Once we have that, we can carry out these calculations, use our operator k, and then we have a uniquely predicted Casimir force. And then we can compare that with experiment. Okay? So this is really the point. Okay, now what is left to do? Of course, a lot. Well, first of all, we work here with this very simple case, one-dimensional case, real massless scale fields. So we can go through three dimensions, of course, and then Casimir force experiments are carried out with electromagnetic fields. So we have to do that with QED, of course. And then this is probably the final real aim of the full work, is that this should be also carried out for all the other cases I've been talking about, I talked about at the beginning, especially inflation, black hole spectrum, or gamma ray bursts. That means we'd like to have somehow an equivalent or the analogous of our K operator, something that would take dispersion relation and then map it essentially one-to-one into the particular physical thing that we want to go and measure. So in the case of inflation, it would be some function or whatever that takes dispersion relations and map them into some effects in the CMB. Same for black hole physics. So I guess this is still pretty far away, and this is probably much more complicated than what we did for the Casimir effects. But at least with this calculation, we show that it is somehow possible to do, at least in this case, and we can hope that something analogous can be done in these other more complicated cases. Thanks.
I guess I'm trying to understand the perspective and classified theory has to come first. Suppose we measure what the Casimir force is, and we find it has some behavior. Mm-hmm. From that, we should be able to infer what G is, or at least what G is within a certain range. Mm-hmm. So why can't we just say, phenomenologically, this is G, and then, okay, whatever theory you have better match that phenomenology. So I don't see, I don't know what you mean by okay. What you mean when you say theory has to
okay.
Be first.
So, you go to measure your thing, and you can fit G in this negative, you can fit G and you know G in this negative part. Okay? You know G of minus K.
Yeah. Okay.
So then you have to even continue it in the positive part. In the positive, on the positive axis. But this you can have any arbitrary behavior on the positive axis here, because for sure the continuation is unique, but since you have experimental variance, this is enough if you have a certain, essentially your force is going to define G on a certain variance as well. So you can use this variance to have essentially any behavior you want on the positive. This is what I tried to
within limits of that experimental error.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, experimental error. So this is what I tried to show with this little example. Well, you could turn it, twist it around. You can have fit this part here. Yeah. Let's say, well, we have experiments, right? It's about Casimir force, and we know it's up to 1% above, I think, close to the 1 L squared force that we have. So essentially we have here something that is just linear, right? But what I say is that you can have this peak now rebuilt here or anything that you want on this part. So that by going measuring the force, there is essentially no way of guessing what's gonna happen on the other side of the dispersion relation. Is it more clear now?
Well, I sort of see that. Then how would theory help? Because then it would be determined by, in part, philosophical prejudice, right? Somebody will say, one group will say, well, we like a key that has a peak over here in the positive axis, and another game will say, no, we want a series of peaks, and if they're all indistinguishable, then doesn't that mean
I'm not saying
science is up against a brick wall here?
I'm not saying you have to guess your dispersion relations. What I'm saying is you have to try and build well, that's what you are talking through, right?
Well, it would be determined by theoretical prejudice, but if we never have any way of determining what's on that other part of the axis,
maybe there's a way of writing down explicitly my theory, which would really give me my dispersion relation on the positive axis, okay? But then I have a function there. So this function, there's a unique way of continuing it in the negative.
Well, sure. But
I have no chance of.
Well, I understand that. It's just that I can come up with one theory that it continues one way into the experimental regime, and somebody else comes up with something completely different, but in the experimental regime, they continue the same way in limits of error. So I'm saying this is. The conclusion is, in fact, if that's right, very discouraging, because we don't have any way of experiment determining which of those two theories
are right. But you can still have two theories that come up with two things that diverge completely on the other side, and at least you can distinguish between these two. So that's already good.
But I thought you just said you could distinguish.
No, it is a good point, but somebody comes up with a divergence theory and says this should be the dispersed relation for my theory.
Yeah.
Okay, now you crank the machine here and you get the cardinal force, you get it. You can go out and check, and if it doesn't match what the guy said, then the theory doesn't work. And on the other hand, if somebody else comes up with a different kind of gravity theory, says this is my dispersion relation, crank the machinery, you get the cardinal force, you get
it. But if you're right.
But I thought he just said you only check at a certain spot, and then you.
All right,
well, now.
If you have a function for the dispersion, the actual formula, not just something with an error, but the actual formula, then you know it everywhere, including the cardinal force.
Right.
So, if from some.
But two people could come up with different actual formulas that are empirically indistinguishable and we can measure widely different.
That's true. But you can also have two people going with two different theories. That on these other regions.
Yeah, you could so obviously kill off some, but.
Yeah, okay.
An interesting scenario could be that one group has a quantum gravity theory, not a dispersed relation, another group has another quantum gravity theory with a dispersed relation that looks very similar, but it's not quite the same. Experimentally, it would be the same, but formulas are somewhat different. You crank the machinery in both cases, and you get two different cardinal forces, and you could experiment using the same theory.
But he's saying within limits of error that might not be possible. That's
not
what I'm trying to get at. I agree if you could distinguish them, one will be killed and the other that might live. But if you can't, then you can't.
Well, what I said was in the other way. If you first of all go and measure it, and you don't have this background theory,
right.
then essentially you can't distinguish. But if first of all you come with a theory, then you can. For at least in some cases, distinguish radically the difference between the two, and you can get some of your theories away.
But isn't this a bit like, we know the mass, the electron, and the muon, and everybody and his cousin can come up with theories that predict those masses, but in fact, it's such a small number of data points that we don't learn anything, and after 30 plus years of gauge theories, we don't have any explanation for the particle masses. So it seems to me this is not too dissimilar from that. Somebody will go out and measure the force, whatever it is, but we could have a plethora of different theories, all of which agree within limits of error for that force. Is that a correct statement?
Well, that's a correct statement.
Okay.
But you have also another bunch of theories. That would not go into.
Yeah, sure, you'll kill off some. I'm not going to dispute that.
Okay,
that's fine.
One question.
Yeah?
I have two rather different questions. Let me ask this rather different one first. There's another way of thinking about Kassinger force that people talk about, which is in terms of the triangle between the charged particles in place.
Yeah.
Now, is it possible, that implicitly is assuming that QED or some, not really all of QED, but some particular theory, is it meaningful to deform that theory according to a different dispersion relation and ask what you would get if you did the calculation that way? And, or is it not a well-defined question? If it is well-defined, then you can ask whether you can see the same thing in that other way.
Well, I guess you can try to do it. I don't see any reason why you couldn't.
It would seem that you could, because a different dispersion relation would be a different Coulomb force, basically.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Coulomb force.
Yeah.
See whether or not.
Well, so I guess this is something that you don't have. hopefully all the same answer.
It's modification, right? So.
Well, but if he puts in a dispersion division, then presumably that uniquely determines the Coulombic type force in all distances.
Yeah, but all you know is, that's my point, if all you know is long distance, then you've got a lot of options at short distance.
No, no, but I'm just saying he has a whole theory of how the force is related to the dispersion relationship. So
you can
do that. Could you reinterpret that? Would you get the same results if you did the calculation?
I have the impression you were just being much more committed to than this approach, but I don't know. I haven't tried to do it, so I can't tell you.
The other comes in was, I suppose it's, I mean, so that isn't what's bothering a lot of people, so I'm just trying to see if I can figure out this. So let's take it from the other side. So given the positive, given the dispersion relation, the physical dimension, you're making some disturbing claim, so I'm trying to see if I can isolate what that claim is. I think you're saying, given any dispersion relation, I could find another one arbitrarily close to it in some measure. It's completely different pattern of influence.
Yeah.
So that's what you're coming at.
Yeah.
And so what does arbitrarily close to it mean? Does that mean?
Well, essentially.
Is that a uniform norm, or is it? In some sense, in which we could say what arbitrarily close.
That's a really hard question.
Well, if you want to.
I'm not asking for the best possible statement, but the kind of because. You could find one that deviates by no more than
Yeah. Well, that's essentially what I was thinking of.
Yeah.
But you see, the thing is that it might be a rather contrived example that you have.
Because you look at it, it's going to oscillate very, very rapidly.
Yeah, you would have some really linear looking like behavior, and then in the negative part, right, you would have some funny stuff happen. You wouldn't expect.
And yeah, but never mind, it's negative part. What's it going to look like in the positive part? It's
very close to it.
Yeah, but so, I mean, you're doing essentially nothing to it.
Yeah.
We'll see nothing funny, it's like very rapid oscillation.
No.
And.
Yeah. And basically, our prediction of the cardinal force can be viewed as saying that we just assume that the dispersion relation is really linear all the way, to, not just to the positive part, but also to the negative part. It's just a simple assumption. I mean, what the statement here is that you can always find infinitely many times differentiable function that will do whatever the dispersion relation, and the same time whatever cardinal force you want up to a finite epsilon that you may prescribe. But it may be very contrived function, it may not be the simplest one. So if you put in some condition on my dispersion relation has to be polynomial of degree of more than 5, then you can't do it.
Does this mean there's something wrong with the original derivation of the cardinal force in some sense?
No. If you know that the dispersion relation is exactly linear,
exactly linear,
but then it is unique that you get one over r squared.
The question is, why should that? I mean, it's hard to believe. I mean, we don't believe it. Maybe we don't believe it's exactly linear.
Yeah.
In an actual medium, you know.
Right.
If we're living in a medium, we're not living in absolute reality space.
Yeah.
So that would completely change everything.
Well, that could. I mean, we just built one function that changes everything. It doesn't mean that it is the case.
But the thing is, for example, if we were to now measure the dispersion relation to very, very large energy, and we start finding deviations from the experimentally, then I suppose the strategy would be to say, okay, let's assume that the dispersion relation is linear up to some small degree polynomial correction. And then again, we try to form it, then we get some thing for the cardinal form. But as a demonstrator, it depends on the pattern, even where you truncate, where you say that's the degree of my polynomial. Because if you look at the actual asymptotic behavior of the cardinal force, it depends crucially on what the highest degree of